Yeah, Wendigos, and good evening to all my favorite Nikons out there. Tonight's a bit of a treat. We're coming to you live from my favorite little watering hole in the whole wide world, the Ironclad. It's quiz night, and tonight your hostess with the mostest, your queen of the questions, is none other than yours truly, who is ready to play. Awesome. Well, before we get started, let's lay out the ground rules. I'm going to ask five questions based on tonight's theme. You have five slips of paper in front of you. Write your answers on there. After every question, my second-in-command will collect your answers and either mark you with a point or not. Tonight, the Riker to my Picard is none other than everyone's favorite Spaceball, host of WHAU's The Skies Have Eyes, the Revelator. Everyone give him a hand.
Boo!
Keep it down, Team Ops.
Thanks, MW. And I'm also going to be scanning the crowd, making sure that no one's using their cell phones to cheat. Cheaters get thrown into the snake pit out back. Sam's words, not mine.
Which reminds me, owner Sam Harville is behind the bar tonight, serving up two-for-one drink specials on all your favorites, including the Batrachian IPA, Noden's Wheat, her world-famous Eldritch Stout, and brand new to the menu, Red Rum, a rum barrel-aged red ale concocted with strict supervision by Sam, entirely by the Ironclad's newest brewmistress apprentice, Colleen. Give it a try. And remember, folks, this ain't their hobby. Dig deep in those pockets and tip the ladies. All right, let's meet the teams. On Team Ops, we have Chris and Toby. Hey, Chris, up to date on cryptid creatures?
Yeah, but man, I've been listening to this totally great new podcast called The Others, available now on iTunes and Stitcher.
Yeah, that guy Ron, he totally gets me.
You're not alone there, man. Okay, on Team Ia, here we goes. We have Gwenacy and Tafonda.
Gwenacy!
On the Fuzz, we have Lieutenant Woolley and Officer Caligari. Glad you can make it, Lieutenant. You're not on duty, right?
Sure.
Okay. On Team Better Than You, we have Charlotte and Keel from the Honors College. And finally, on the Hot Toddies, we have Gore and Kilt. Hi, Gore. How are classes going, hon?
Best I've had in a century.
Great to hear. And Kilt, always a pleasure.
Hey, MW. Oh, and just so you know, we've expanded the toddy list and emailed you an updated copy of the spreadsheet. Mind the section labeled Terrifying Beyond All Description, okay?
Noted. All right, ladybugs and jelly spoons, are we ready for our first question? Tonight's theme is Know Your School. All the questions will have to do with Alexandria University, both past and present. The winner tonight will take home an AU t-shirt and an Ironclad pint glass. With that in mind, here's our first question. What is the oldest building on campus? What is the oldest building on campus? Everyone set? Next question. Everyone knows about AU's super secret secret society, the Broken Spears. Who is the Broken Spears' current student chieftain? Next question. Almost everyone here has been to the King's Library on campus, and if you haven't, you've likely heard or definitely felt the distinctive chiming of the clock tower. Who is the King's Library named for? Who is the King's Library named for? Question 4. Many of you feel like you bleed yellow and green, but those aren't our official school colors. What are AU's official school colors? What are the official school colors? And our last question. Everyone has likely seen the massive statue in front of our town hall of the Alexandria University crest. Below the crest is the AU school motto. What is our school motto? And bonus points if you can tell me what it translates to. Okay, everyone got the questions? Well, night gone, so while the teams ruminate on their trivial pursuits, we can pull out the old skeleton key and unlock the Alexandria archives. I've been holding on to tonight's story for a while. An archiving intern at the Halsey Memorial Library stumbled across these recordings when cleaning out some boxes. She told me it was supposed to be part of an exhibit from back in the 60s that never got off the ground. I was never really sure when it'd be a good time to share this story, but since I'm coming to you live from the Ironclad, the best damn pub in the state, it feels like too perfect a chance to pass it up. Here it is.
Everything I'm about to relay is true. I will endeavor to the best of my abilities to recount the events accurately, with little to no alteration. If there is an instance where a license must be taken, well, you'll just have to pardon me that. I'm old, and my memory ain't what it used to be. I'm submitting this account for the record at the request of the Alexandria Historical Society after they unearth something they are calling historically significant to the town of Alexandria, North Carolina. The historic artifact in question is a copper moonshiner's still that once belonged to the Prohibition bootlegger and moonshiner, Josephus Laughing Joe Maney. It is my hope, after listening to my account of the events which transpired during what the papers would eventually call the Swamp Shine Horror, that the board of the Alexandria Historical Society will relegate those dark materials back to the swamp from which they came. My name is Cranston Wilcox. My father was Dr. Frederick Allen Wilcox, professor of chemistry at the University of Alexandria. My upbringing was a loving one. My mother was one of God's own angels, and my father, though firm, was fair. I was a rotten, spoiled child, who, given any opportunity to rebel, would do so with relish. Looking back now, I don't know what I was rebelling against, except my family, their money, and my own name. It only became worse when I joined the same university at which my father taught. It seems shameful now, thinking on it, but the past is beyond the realm of revision. This was 45 years ago, 1922. Prohibition had settled into Alexandria like a well-fitted sweater. The making and distributing of hooch, of course, was illegal. But with only a single sheriff and his two deputies in the entire town who frequented the speakeasies as often as the rest of us, no one was eager to enforce the law. The hooch was made by the town shiner, Josephus Maney. The rest of the town knew him as Laughing Joe Maney, but I was introduced to him as Uncle Joe. Laughing Joe was my best friend Phil's uncle. Joe took in Phil when his daddy ran off the summer of 4, and then his mama died of brain fever some months later. Joe was a long, dark man, with kindly eyes, a smile half covered by long white whiskers, and wasn't quick to the switch the way I remembered Phil's daddy being. And he showed us the workings of the still. How the smoke would curl up from neath the boils, moving the steam of the corn mash up the tubing and drip clear as rainwater into the clay jugs, repeating the process 3 or 4 times to remove impurities, marking the jugs with an X for every run. Farmer's piss, he called it, and warned us not to drink too much too quickly, lest we go blind. Of what happened to Laughing Joe, I'll say only this. Phil and I had drank our share at the speak that night, and instead of trying to walk the 3 miles back to the dormitories on campus, we decided to sleep our intoxication away till morning in Joe's cabin, only about a 30 miles from the pub. It were likely 3, maybe 4 in the a.m. when we heard a crash from the kitchen, the rattlings and bangings of someone stumbling around. I looked over at Phil and saw he were awake. He told me he figured his uncle was drunk on his own shine again. But then the crash came again, this time followed by a tortured cat with a scream. Phil and I leapt from the bed, still half bleary from drink, and swung open the door. Joe was there, hunched over the table and sobbing like a child. Phil ran to his side and asked him, "Uncle, what's the matter? What's the matter, Uncle? What happened?" Before I knew what was happening, Laughing Joe had grabbed my friend by the throat and had driven him to the floor.
"I don't need nobody from this town," he were yelling. "I don't need nobody from nowhere. The old folks come. The deepens. They tell me all I need is the swamp. The deepens come and tell me how the sky work. They tell me how the world spin. They tell me what sleeps at the bottom of the sea. They say it almost time. They say the stars almost right. I don't need nobody from this town. All I need is the swamp. The deepens tell me why the ghost lights shine, where the stupid god spins blind and deaf to the sound of his flute players. Can you hear the flutes?"
He was shaking Phil, and I was struck dumb from the shock of it. He shook Phil again and hollered, "Can you hear it, boy?" I snapped out of my stupor and pulled the old shiner off my friend. He stumbled around, shaking his head and banging into the shelves, finally fumbling out the back door and down the porch stairs. It was then, as he stepped into the light of the moon, that I realized that his shirt were torn away, and he had a cut across his back. From where I stood, the shallow cut looked like a stick figure drawn of a tree branch or twig, with a long center stem and three arms pointing out one side and two arms sticking out the other. I helped Phil to his feet and asked him if we should go after him. He said no, he'd probably drank a bad batch and it scrambled up his brains a bit. He should be fine by morning, but Laughing Joe Maney was never seen again. Authorities reckoned he stumbled his way into the swamp, ran a path of some hungry gator, and, well, that's all she wrote. People got lost in the swamp and never came out again at least once a year in those days. Likely that's where the legend of the Dismal Swamp Devil came from, but I digress. It was perhaps 2 months after Laughing Joe's disappearance. Phil had been filling Joe's old orders from the stores in his cellar, but supplies were running thin. I can't remember who suggested we pick up where Joe left off, Phil or me. I'd like to believe it was Phil, but knowing the boy I was, I suspect it was me. Now, I could explain how he spent the next few weeks boiling up the mash and the barley and the grain, filling Joe's old orders and making a handsome little penny, but truth told, that's not the story I'm telling. The story I set out to tell began on the night of a gibbous moon. I was working the mash, and Phil had headed out into the swamp to rustle up some kindling. I was sitting near the fire, having a smoke, when the sound came from off yonder. A sort of chirping or yipping. First I suspected it was some critter scurrying about like a coon or a fox, but then the chirping became a low hissing, which then became a gurgling. From the other end of the clearing came a second, answering, hissing gurgle. In the light of the fire from the boiler, the swamp around looked little more than a gray and blue wall with streaks of tall black marking the silhouettes of the sycamores. Behind me came a third chirping, more of a clicking, followed by a wet, throaty gurgle. We kept a shotgun by the still in case of bears and the like, and rest assured I scooped her up and held her close to my chest. With my free hand, I found the flashlight I kept nearby and clicked it on, shining the beam into the tree line. But nothing was there. I stood and stepped carefully away from the light of the fire and squinted deep into the dark of the swamp. The clicking and hissing had stopped, and I walked slowly and carefully along the ring of trees. Behind me, the sound of footsteps and a twig snapping made me jerk round, swinging the light and the shotgun alike at the source of the noise. As I did, something stepped out of the light and moved quickly behind one of the sycamores. Phil, if you're having a joke with me, I yelled out into the woods, you'd best quick step out from behind those trees, lest you're likely to get shot. The gurgling hissing came again. It moved from one side of me to the other. The loud clicking answered again, and this time from behind me. Something had me surrounded. I took a few hesitant steps back without looking behind. I very nearly pulled the trigger when I knocked into a couple of the barrels. From either sides of the beam of light, I saw vague hints of movement. Dark outlines against the blackness of the swamp. Impressions of a head and shoulders. I must admit I was frozen with terror. A chill, what had nothing to do with the dark, damp air, crawled up my legs and made them powerful shook. In the end, what finally made me move was the sharp bang of something hitting the metal behind me. I swung my gun around and very nearly sent my dear friend back to the Lord. He had gotten back to the clearing and had unloaded his bundle of firewood. One of the branches had hit the still as he dropped it. Seeing me there, white as a sheet, and pointing the barrels of a shotgun at him made him very nearly faint with fright. When I saw it were only him, I dropped the gun and apologized profusely. I asked him, was it him making them sounds in the woods? He told me he were whistling as he came back in. Was that what I heard? It wasn't, of course, but I shook my head and told him it must have been. Must have been jumping at shadows, was all. I sat back down at my stump and Phil joined, sitting on the other side of the fire, rolling up his sleeves as I pulled out my pipe and filled it full of tobacco. Had I not been on edge already, I likely wouldn't have seen it. But as it was, I caught a glimpse of what were on Phil's arm. I scurried over to the other end of the fire where my friend sat and demanded to know where he'd come by it. He held up his arm and looked at it. What, this? 'Tain't nothing but a scratch that I picked up while searching for kindling is all. Where's Cranston? What's gone into you? You jittery as a nun on a first communion. You been pulling from the barrels or something? I assured him I hadn't, and it were nothing but my mind playing tricks on me. But I knew it weren't. I'd seen that same cut of four. Laughing Joe had it across his back the night he disappeared. The night he went off his rocker yelling about the swamp and the deepens. The strange branch shape cut with three arms on one side and two on the t'other. If the Lord today were to tell me to point to him where it all started, I reckon that night, that scratch should be it. The hissing and clicking didn't come back after that night, but something had come over Phil. Some nights later, I found Phil hauling buckets of water into the clearing. I asked him where he'd come by it, since we usually brought fresh water in from the pack walk. He told me it was from the swamp. I argued that the water would be too full of scum for Hooch, but Phil just turned away from me and poured his buckets into the vat.
"Everything we need," he said, picking up his buckets as he walked into the tree line, "we can get from the swamp."
He had covered his cut arm with gauze and avoided using it if he could. I was nervous about the bog water and the shine making folks sick, but to my surprise, they couldn't get enough of it. The speak doubled their order and folk were calling in even for home deliveries. Sure, we were making fine money, and I was all too happy to thumb my nose at my father, who was well aware of my extracurricular activities. He threatened to report me to the sheriff until he saw me bringing him and his deputies a bottle to the station. Still, though, during this time I refused to drink our own product. My daddy was a chemist, recall. I had no idea what kind of nastiness was lurking about in that bog water, and I wanted no part of it. What I should have done was put an end to it the moment I saw my friend hauling that water in from the marsh. What happened next was just as much my fault as his. One of our recurring customers was Mrs. Flannery. She was a sweet old widow whose late husband was a custodian at the university. I enjoyed bringing her the shine, and we'd sit in her parlor and she'd tell me about growing up in Alexandria. She was a darling lady with a heart of an angel and a mouth of a sailor after a few teacups full. Seeing her drink the swamp liquor made me ill, but I was too much of a coward to tell her. I brought her two bottles of the hooch without a problem to be seen. On the third delivery, however, Mrs. Flannery's door was wide open when I pulled up. I called out her name just to be certain I didn't frighten her if she were working in the back garden. No answer. I felt it before I walked up to the steps of her door. The overall wrongness of it. The quiet were just too quiet. An unnatural quiet. Step by wary step, I took them stairs and glanced in through her door. It was clear as I walked into the foyer, but there was a smell. Like swamp water and stink bugs. I called her name again and stepped in. It was hot. Hotter than it had any right to be. The air was heavy and wet, like a boiler room. I took my cap off and brushed the sweat off my forehead as I moved into her parlor. The room was empty, but the temperature had gone up. The smell was oppressive. I had a cousin who raised hogs out in Watauga. I had been inside the pens they was kept in. That was the smell that weighed you down, let me tell you. The smell coming from this house made those pens seem like a breath of fresh air. It was the kind of smell that got stuck underneath your fingernails. I started to feel lightheaded as I stepped into the kitchen. A pot of something was sitting on the stove and looked like it had been there for a few days. The brown and black gel inside was spotted with gray-green fuzz. I felt uncomfortable being in Mrs. Flannery's home, not knowing if anyone were here. I called her name again, hoping she'd be asleep upstairs all along, but the house was silent as the grave. Quietly, I moved to the stairs, but froze at their foot. I don't know how long I stood there, staring up at the second floor, but I knew I absolutely did not want to see what was at the top of them. I called out Mrs. Flannery's name again, but a hollow sound and echo was all I got in response. The first step creaked under my weight and I winced at the break in silence. The heat spiked up again as I moved up. The smell was musty and thick with rot. At the top of the stairs, there were two rooms right next to each other. The first one, the door was wide open, and I could see inside. There was no one there. The second door was closed, and that filled me with a cold, thin terror. I clenched my jaw and moved forward to the door. The knob was warm to the touch, and a voice at the back of my head told me to turn round and walk out the door and not look back. I wanted nothing more in that moment than to run and not stop, but something between crushing guilt and morbid curiosity drove me forward. Slowly, I turned the knob and pushed open the door. The smell was like being socked in the stomach. It took the wind out of you. The heat was thick as tar. There was a dusty haze that caught the light. And there, standing in the window, was Mrs. Flannery. She stood facing away from me and wore a thin robe that she held together, bunched up at her stomach. It was plastered to her body from sweat that covered every inch of her. I called out for her name and asked her if she felt all right. Should I fetch the doctor? But she said nothing. Instead, she gave me a dry, wheezing breath and turned to face me. I took an involuntary step back. Her face had been cut up bad. Deep, bleeding gashes went from her lip to her temple, and her eyes. Now, I know what you might think. She were old, and that's a normal thing, but I'd spent time with her. And she had eyes green as ivy and sharp as shoe tacks. But now, in the course of 2 weeks, they had gone milky and white, like an old dog. Her arms and legs were covered in a greenish sores and shimmered in the sunlight like a back of a frog. And as she took a step forward, I saw she was holding an old kitchen knife in her hand. There was blood on it. She took another jerking step toward me, and I took a step back. The hand she held the robe closed with, bunched up with fabric, dropped to her side, and the garment opened down the middle. She was naked beneath. And on her stomach, she had cut a long, shallow line stretching from her pelvis to her lower ribs. I could see a smaller cut branching out from either side of the center cut, and for a minute, I didn't know what I was looking at. Then she moved again, and the cut shifted with the twisting of her body. I could see the design directly now, and I recognized it almost instantly. The same cut on Laughing Joe's back the night he up and disappeared. The one on Phil's arm, the one he reckoned he'd gotten from stomping around in the woods in the dark. Mrs. Flannery stepped again, the floorboards creaking beneath her feet. There's teeth in the swamp, boy. Teeth that catch you, Ken. I glanced up at the old lady. Till then, I was so scared I had practically forgotten she could talk. I frantically asked her if she needed help. I told her I'd drive into town, fetch the doctor, bring him back. But she just took another step toward me, the knife hanging lazily at her side. This swamp, she give all a body need here. I don't need nobody no how. All's I need is the swamp. The deepens told me so. Such lovely teeth the folk have. They said all I need is the swamp. She took another step and bent over coughing. Loud, racking coughs, and when she stood up again, her mouth was dripping with blood and green phlegm. I took another step back and held my hand out to keep her away. She slowly raised the knife and took one last step toward me. I jerked away, slipping on the top stair and tumbling all the way down the steps, cracking my face against the banister at the bottom. It hurt for a split second, and then the world went black. When I came to, I was lying face down in a puddle of my own blood. I glanced at the top of the stairs, but I couldn't see anything. Dizzy and shaking, still bleeding from where I hit my head good, I wobbled my way out to my truck. I drove as fast as I could back to the still. It was hard work since my head was still throbbing. When I finally made it back, Phil was hunched over the cook fire, stirring a pot of something boiling. He didn't turn to me as I hopped out of my truck and told him that the widow Flannery had gone nutty off the swamp liquor. I made my way back to the water barrel we kept around to wash ourselves and splash cold water on my face. I looked back at Phil and realized he hadn't turned around, hadn't responded, hadn't said anything since I'd got there. "You hear me?" I called. "I think the hooch making folks sick." A cup some water into my mouth, swished it around a bit and spat it out. She was clamoring out the same hee-haw laughing Joe was the night he disappeared. Such about swamp all she needin', something about deepens talking to her. Phil just sat hunched over the pot, slowly stirring. I was annoyed. My head hurt, and now my pal was ignoring me. "Hey, Phil!" I moved to jostle him on the back. I was a few steps behind him when I stopped short. In front of Phil was a dead stump of a tree. Carved on the trunk, likely by Phil's old hunting knife, was the mark. The same symbol I'd seen on Laughing Joe and the Widow and Phil. The center line with five branching arms. As I stared at it, I noticed the half-dead sycamore behind it. The self-same symbol had been carved into its trunk, too. I hazarded a glance at the trees to my left and to my right of the clearing, but every trunk, every stump, hell, every flat surface, including the old copper still, had strange, angular shapes scratched into it. "The deepens said my eyes tell me lies," Phil said, breaking the silence. "What's going on here, Phil?" I took a step back. "They told me my eyes had been lying to me since before I was born, when I was still one with Azathoth, and he knew me spinning and biting. He knew my eyes, and they says my eyes is a lie." "Who told you that, Phil?" His back was to me. He pointed out to the swamp, where the trees were thick. The sun was setting behind me and coloring the whole place in a brilliant golden light. It really was beautiful. I stared into the woods, squinting past the pain I felt in my head. Far off in the tree line, at the center of a soupy black lake, was an ancient cypress that stood massive and eldritch. I had never really taken notice of it till that day. To this day, I can't tell you if what I saw next was a trick of the light, my mind playing tricks on me, or the real deal. But as I stared into the trees at the center of the pond, something slithered its way out of the water. It reached one arm, then another, gripping the roots of the tree, climbing root by root until it was at the base of the trunk. Its bloated body was covered in a slick gray skin that glistened in the setting sun. Its arms were human-like, but its fingers were webbed and moved with the slow fatuity of something reptilian. When it turned its head in my direction, I very nearly cried out in terror. Its eyes were large, wet, and bulbous. Its mouth was wide and frog-like and showed hundreds of needle-thin teeth. And I heard the gurgling hiss I'd heard on that terrible night. I heard voices in my head and saw a vision of a thing that brought me to the very edge of my sanity. I kicked back and tripped over my own feet, falling hard on my ass. "They told me all I need is the swamp. The swamp at sea for me." Slowly, my best friend turned around and faced me for the first time. His shirt was torn open and covered in blood. Lines of blood dripped down his cheeks from where his bright blue eyes used to be. In that place were two black, empty sockets. He bored his own eyes out of his head. "The swamp's all I need, Cranston. It's all we need." He pulled the spoon he was using to stir the steaming, boiling pot. It dripped with thick, black sludge. He pulled the torn, bloody shirt to one side and showed me his chest. Over his heart, he had cut deep into his skin the shape cut into trees, cut into the Widow Flannery, cut into Laughing Joe. He slapped the spoon against his cut, splashing black sludge across his chest and into the bloody open wound below his nipple. "The Elder Sign lets him know they's home. Lets him know they's welcome." Terrified beyond all explanation, I scrambled backwards onto my hands and heels when my back hit something hard. I chanced to look upward and saw the Widow Flannery staring down at me. She coughed and a green sputum hit my cheeks and eyes. I rolled away from her and wiped the slime out of my eyes. I stumbled to my feet and made for the truck. From out of the woods, figures were moving in toward the clearing. As they got closer, I began to recognize folks from the town. Jimmy, the speakeasy owner, the sheriff and his two deputies, Winnie Hooper, the old piano teacher. They moved slowly but with purpose towards the clearing. On their arms, legs, chests, faces, I could see the bloody smears where they had carved the symbol of the Elder Sign into their flesh. I saw three young boys who had cut their eyes out the way Phil had. And they were murmuring how all they needed was the swamp. I pressed myself against the door of my truck and they walked past me like they didn't know or didn't care that I was there. I finally realized that they were moving toward the copper still, towards the swamp liquor. These folks of the town had all gone crazy off the swamp liquor. Whatever was at the center of the lake was making them all hysterical. I needed to do something. I couldn't just let these folks hurt themselves and others. This was half my fault after all. I moved to the front of my truck and cranked it to life. Then I jumped behind the wheel, put it in gear, and accelerated hard towards the boiler. I slammed into the copper cylinders with all the power of 20 horses. The steel flew into the tree line, spilling out the liquor everywhere, which burst into flames when it hit the fire. I watched the copper still roll down the hill, into the bank, and down into the water. The fire was licking up the trees when the crazed folks of the town turned toward me and my truck. They had murder in their eyes, and I knew that in that moment, unless I made a break for it right then and there, they'd tear me limb from limb. I shoved the truck into reverse, moved away from the growing fire, and pulled off down the dirt road. Behind me, I could see the folks running after my truck, but I quickly pulled away from them. Smoke was lifting up out of the swamp when the fire hit the wet wood. In all, the fire killed 6 people, including Phil. The other 39 folk who'd drank too much of the swamp liquor made their way back to Alexandria and began tormenting the town, throwing trash cans through windows, tearing apart local businesses, completely destroying the speakeasy. I learned this secondhand, of course, from my mother, as I had skipped town. I reckon they were searching with all their might for the last bits of the swamp liquor we had delivered before I destroyed it. They tormented the town of Alexandria for 2 days until the other locals decided they had had enough and assembled a mob to deal with the problem. It was an ugly confrontation, but they managed to lock up the ruffians in the old textile mill until they slept it off. Only they seemed to get worse as time passed. They wouldn't touch no food or drink offered. They just got angrier, more rowdy. It was thought they'd break down the damn walls before long until day 3, when the first one keeled over dead. After that, they began falling like flies. Every few hours, one would collapse wherever it happened to be, coughing up some green stuff and expire. By the end of the 5th day, all 39 swamp liquor crazed hooligans were dead. It made the state news, and while it said folks had gone crazy after drinking swamp water, it never made mention of myself, Phil Maney, or the still. I never went back to Alexandria. I moved out to Hickory and eventually met my wife. There ain't a day that goes by that I don't see the faces of those folks in the swamp, or the thing at the center of the lake. There ain't a day that goes by that I don't see the images that it put in my head when it showed me just what's sleeping beneath the town of Alexandria.
I hope you all enjoyed that. Well, the crowd has had some time to converse with their answers, and all the slips have been handed in and tallied. So without further gilding the lily, here are the answers to tonight's quiz. Number 1, what is the oldest building on campus? The answer is Cadott Hall. Construction was completed in 1857, 3 years after the school's founding. And while Cadott Hall is mostly used for administration today, the building actually sits on the former site of the first university building. Legend has it that the blizzard hit Alexandria the year of its founding. It was so bad that our founder Elliot Pritchard, his wife, brother-in-law, and the only 4 students of the university were trapped in the original building's speaking hall for 6 days. And when they dug their way out on the 6th day, Mrs. Pritchard wasn't with them. It's this story, added to the fact that the following year the school mascot officially became the Wendigo, that gave rise to the legend that the stranded first class cannibalized Mrs. Pritchard. The original foundations, as well as the ceremonial days, has been preserved exactly where it stood 130 years ago in the sub-basement. Number two, who was a student chieftain to the Broken Spears? The answer, Philip Brandywick. The student body president, rowing team captain, and firm chiseled jaw, has been chieftain since his sophomore year. Traditionally, the president of the Phi Delta Chi House would be president by default, but since all frats and sororas were banned in 1995 after the incident, the role of chieftain must be voted in by unanimous vote by all living spears. Number three, who is the King's Library named for? The answer, Jebediah Nederick Kings, founder of the School of Philosophy and brother-in-law to the founder of Alexandria University, Elliot Pritchard. The urn containing his remains can still be found on the third floor, near the bathrooms. No confirmation yet on the validity of the legend that all new broken spears must snore the line of Jeb's ashes, but I'd like to think that it's true. Number four, what are the official school colors? The answer, gamboge, moss, and fog, which is just fancy talk for orange, yellow, bluey, green, and whitey, gray. For simplicity's sake, often people just assume we're yellow, green, and gray, or just yellow and green. Personally, I like saying gamboge. It's fun. You should try it sometime. Gamboge. And finally, number five, what is the school motto and what does it translate to? The Alexandria University motto is Carnum Sapientia Devoramus, and it translates to... Wait, no one knows what it translates to? Seriously? Gwen, not even you.
I wrote down the answer I was told on orientation day. We take in the most important knowledge. Isn't that it?
No, I'm sorry, honey. That might be what it means colloquially, but that isn't the literal translation. Jeez, shame on y'all. Where's that Wendigo spirit? Tell you what, Nikons, if you know the answer, tweet it to us at WHAUSignal with the hashtag IKnowTheAnswerNW. You can also like us on Facebook and comment the answer there. Next episode, we'll randomly select one of the answers and send that person a free Alexandria University t-shirt. How does that sound? Welp, that's it for me here at the-
Wait, who won?
Oh, sorry. Almost forgot. Looks like, well, it's a team that joined after I finished announcing everyone, actually. Sorry about that, player. It looks like the winner is Team Joan.
Oh, fuck.
Hi there, sweetie. Miss me?